The killing of King brought new urban outbreaks all over the country, in which 39 people were killed, 35 of them black. Evidence was piling up that even with all of the civil rights laws now on the books, the courts would not protect blacks against violence and injustice. 1. In the 1967 riots in Detroit, three black teenagers were killed in the Algiers Motel. Three Detroit policemen and a black private guard were tried for this triple murder. The defense conceded, a UPI dispatch said, that the four men had shot two of the blacks. A jury exonerated them. 2. In Jackson, Mississippi, in the spring of 1970, on the campus of Jackson State College, a Negro college, police laid down a 28-second barrage of gunfire using shotguns, rifles, and a submachine gun. 400 bullets or pieces of buckshot struck the girls' dormitory and two black students were killed. A local grand jury found the attack justified, and U.S. District Court Judge Harold Cox, a Kennedy appointee, declared that students who engage in civil disorders must expect to be injured or killed. 3. In Boston in April 1970, a policeman shot and killed an unarmed black man, a patient in a ward in the Boston City Hospital, firing 5 shots after the black man snapped a towel at him. The chief judge of the Municipal Court of Boston exonerated the policeman. 4. In Augusta, Georgia, in May 1970, 6 Negroes were shot to death during looting and disorder in the city. The New York Times reported, "A confidential police report indicates that at least 5 of the victims were killed by the police. An eyewitness to one of the deaths said he had watched a Negro policeman and his white partner fire 9 shots into the back of a man suspected of looting. They did not fire warning shots or ask him to stop running," said Charles A. Reed, a 38-year-old businessman. 5. In April 1970, a federal jury in Boston found a policeman had used excessive force against 2 black soldiers from Fort Devens, and one of them required 12 stitches in his scalp. The judge awarded the serviceman $3 in damages. These were normal cases, endlessly repeated in the history of the country, coming randomly but persistently out of a racism deep in the institutions, the mind of the country. But there was something else, a planned pattern of violence against militant black organizers, carried on by the police and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. On December 4th, 1969, a little before 5 a.m, a squad of Chicago police, armed with a submachine gun and shotguns, raided an apartment where Black Panthers lived. They fired at least 82 and perhaps 200 rounds into the apartment, killing 21-year-old Black Panther leader Fred Hampton as he lay in his bed, and another Black Panther, Mark Clark. Years later, it was discovered in a court proceeding that the FBI had an informer among the Panthers, and that they had given the police a floor plan of the apartment, including a sketch of where Fred Hampton slept. Was the government turning to murder and terror because the concessions, the legislation, the speeches, the intonation of the civil rights hymn "We Shall Overcome" by President Lyndon Johnson were not working? It was discovered later that the government, in all the years of the civil rights movement, while making concessions through Congress, was acting through the FBI to harass and break up black militant groups. Between 1956 and 1971, the FBI concluded a massive counterintelligence program, known as COINTELPRO, that took 295 actions against black groups. Black militancy seemed stubbornly resistant to destruction. A secret FBI report to President Nixon in 1970 said, "A recent poll indicates that approximately 25% of the black population has a great respect for the Black Panther Party, including 43% of blacks under 21 years of age." Was there fear that blacks would turn their attention from the controllable field of voting to the more dangerous arena of wealth and poverty, of class conflict? In 1966, 70 poor black people in Greenville, Mississippi, occupied an unused Air Force barracks until they were evicted by the military. A local woman, Mrs. Unita Blackwell, said, I feel that the federal government have proven that it don't care about poor people. Everything that we have asked for through these years had been handed down on paper. It's never been a reality. We, the poor people of Mississippi, is tired. We're tired of it, so we're going to build for ourselves because we don't have a government that represents us. Out of the 1967 riots in Detroit came an organization devoted to organizing black workers for revolutionary change. This was the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which lasted until 1971 and influenced thousands of black workers in Detroit during its period of activity. The new emphasis was more dangerous than civil rights because it created the possibility of blacks and whites uniting on the issue of class exploitation. Back in November 1963, A. Philip Randolph had spoken to an AFL-CIO convention about the civil rights movement and foreseen its direction. The Negroes' protest today is but the first rumbling of the underclass. As the Negro has taken to the streets, so will the unemployed of all races take to the streets. Attempts began to do with blacks what had been done historically with whites, to lure a small number into the system with economic enticements. There was talk of black capitalism. Leaders of the NAACP and CORE were invited to the White House. James Farmer of CORE, a former freedom rider and militant, was given a job in President Nixon's administration. Floyd McKissick of CORE received a $14 million government loan to build a housing development in North Carolina. Lyndon Johnson had given jobs to some blacks through the Office of Economic Opportunity. Nixon set up an Office of Minority Business Enterprise. Chase Manhattan Bank and the Rockefeller family, controllers of Chase, took a special interest in developing black capitalism. The Rockefellers had always been financial patrons of the Urban League and a strong influence in black education through their support of Negro colleges in the South. David Rockefeller tried to persuade his fellow capitalists that while helping black businessmen with money might not be fruitful in the short run, it was necessary to shape an environment in which the business can continue earning a profit 4 or 5 or 10 years from now. With all of this, black business remained infinitesimally small. The largest black corporation, Motown Industries, had sales in 1974 of $45 million, while Exxon Corporation had sales of $42 billion. The total receipts of black-owned firms accounted for 0.3% of all business income. There was a small amount of change and a lot of publicity. There were more black faces in the newspapers and on television, creating an impression of change, and siphoning off into the mainstream a small but significant number of black leaders. Some new black voices spoke against this. Robert Allen, Black Awakening in Capitalist America, wrote, "If the community as a whole is to benefit, then the community as a whole must be organized to manage collectively its internal economy and its business relations with white America. Black business firms must be treated and operated as social property belonging to the general black community, not as the private property of individual or limited groups of individuals. This necessitates the dismantling of capitalist property relations in the black community and their replacement with a planned communal economy." A black woman, Patricia Robinson, in a pamphlet distributed in Boston in 1970 entitled "Poor Black Woman," tied male supremacy to capitalism and said the black woman allies herself with the have-nots in the wider world and their revolutionary struggles. She said the poor black woman did not in the past question the social and economic system, but now she must, and in fact, she has begun to question aggressive male domination and the class society which enforces it, capitalism. Another black woman, Margaret Wright, said she was not fighting for equality with men if it meant equality in the world of killing, the world of competition. "I don't want to compete on no damned exploitative level. I don't want to exploit nobody. I want the right to be black and me." The system was working hard, by the late 60s and early 70s, to contain the frightening explosiveness of the black upsurge. Blacks were voting in large numbers in the South, and in the 1968 Democratic Convention, 3 blacks were admitted into the Mississippi delegation. By 1977, more than 2,000 blacks held office in 11 southern states. In 1965, the number was 72. There were 2 congressmen, 11 state senators, 95 state representatives, 267 county commissioners, 76 mayors, 824 city council members, 18 sheriffs or chiefs of police, 508 school board members. It was a dramatic advance. But blacks, with 20% of the South's population, still held less than 3% of the elective offices. A New York Times reporter, analyzing the new situation in 1977, pointed out that even where blacks held important city offices, whites almost always retained economic power. After Maynard Jackson, a black, became mayor of Atlanta, the white business establishment continued to exert its influence. Those blacks in the South who could afford to go to downtown restaurants and hotels were no longer barred because of their race. More blacks could go to colleges and universities, to law schools and medical schools. Northern cities were busing children back and forth in an attempt to create racially mixed schools, despite the racial segregation in housing. None of this, however, was halting what Francis Piven and Richard Cloward, in Poor People's Movements, called the destruction of the black lower class, the unemployment, the deterioration of the ghetto, the rising crime, drug addiction, violence. In the summer of 1977, the Department of Labor reported that the rate of unemployment among black youths was 34.8%. A small new black middle class had been created, and it raised the overall statistics for black income, but there was a great disparity between the newly risen middle class black and the poor left behind. Despite the new opportunities for a small number of blacks, the median black family income of 1977 was only about 60% that of whites. Blacks were twice as likely to die of diabetes, 7 times as likely to be victims of homicidal violence rising out of the poverty and despair of the ghetto. A New York Times report in early 1978 said, "The places that have experienced urban riots in the 1960s have, with a few exceptions, changed little, and the conditions of poverty have spread in most cities." Statistics did not tell the whole story. Racism, always a national fact, not just a southern one, emerged in northern cities. As the federal government made concessions to poor blacks in a way that pitted them against poor whites for resources made scarce by the system. Blacks, freed from slavery to take their place under capitalism, had long been forced into conflict with whites for scarce jobs. Now, with desegregation and housing, blacks vied to move into neighborhoods where whites, themselves poor, crowded, troubled, could find in them a target for their anger. In the Boston Globe, November 1977. "A Hispanic family of 6 fled their apartment in the Savin Hill section of Dorchester yesterday after a week of repeated stonings and window smashings by a group of white youths in what appears to have been racially motivated attacks," police said. In Boston, the busing of black children to white schools and whites to black schools set off a wave of white neighborhood violence. The use of busing to integrate schools, sponsored by the government and the courts in response to the black movement, was an ingenious concession to protest. It had the effect of pushing poor whites and poor blacks into competition for the miserable, inadequate schools which the system provided for all the poor. Was the black population, hemmed into the ghetto, divided by the growth of a middle class, decimated by poverty, attacked by the government, driven into conflict with whites, under control? Surely in the mid-70s, there was no great black movement underway, yet a new black consciousness had been born and was still alive. Also, whites and blacks were crossing racial lines in the South to unite as a class against employers. In 1971, 2,000 woodworkers in Mississippi, black and white, joined together to protest a new method of measuring wood that led to lower wages. In the textile mills of J.P. Stevens, where 44,000 workers were employed in 85 plants, mostly in the South, blacks and whites were working together in union activity. In Tifton, Georgia, and Milledgeville, Georgia, in 1977, blacks and whites served together on the union committees of their plants. Would a new black movement go beyond the limits of the civil rights actions of the 60s, beyond the spontaneous urban riots of the 70s, beyond separatism to a coalition of white and black in a historic new alliance. There was no way of knowing this in 1978. In 1978, 6 million black people were unemployed. As Langston Hughes said, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up, or does it explode? If it did explode, as it had in the past, it would come with a certain inevitability out of the conditions of black life in America. And yet, because no one knew when, it would come as a surprise.